Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
It's Tuesday, September 11th, 2018, and this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Carrie Klein, filling in for Joe Moore. On today's show, we continue our in-depth series by my co-host Laura on violence in the healthcare workforce. Plus, we talk with congressional candidate and Fresno County prosecutor Andrew Janz about why he thinks he'll make a better congressman than incumbent Devin Nunes. We also speak with Jim Boren, director of Fresno State's new Institute for Media and Public Trust, about free speech on campus. And we learn about a basket weaving celebration happening in Visalia in honor of California Native American Day.
To begin, however, we look at the subject of immigration. In June, Attorney General Jeff Sessions overturned an Obama-era immigration court ruling involving those seeking asylum in the U.S. due to domestic and gang violence. Before his decision, immigrants in those groups had been eligible for asylum alongside those facing persecution because of race, religion, political opinion, or nationality. But Sessions disagreed, and now those fleeing domestic and gang violence are no longer eligible for asylum. So what's happened to the hundreds of people caught in the system with their own claims? Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez brings us a story of one local woman and what her future might hold.
Hi, chefs. So what you have in front of you is a rabbit and currant pot sticker.
The soft chatter in the waiting room at the Yara Law Group offices in Fresno are muffled by a Food Network show playing on TV. Receptionists tap their keyboards and answer phone calls. A woman from El Salvador, who we'll call Anna, is among the dozen people in the room. A receptionist calls her name and she goes in to see her immigration attorney, Jeremy Clayson. He's preparing documents he'll eventually file with the immigration court in San Francisco. She starts to tell her story. When I first got together with my son's father, everything was normal. Time passed and he became aggressive, violent, and there were moments when he would hit me. Valley Public Radio is granting Anna anonymity because her ex-boyfriend, who's also her son's father, doesn't know where they are now. And she says she fears if he discovers where they are, he'll find them and hurt them. She says the abuse began about a year after they started dating. After her son was born, she says the beatings and verbal abuse got even worse. And the people around to witness it, his family, look the other way. They mistreated me. They mistreated my son like we were people who didn't matter. The beatings were frequent. There was even a moment where he hit me with a machete. His family did nothing to defend me. They pretended like I was an animal who was being mistreated. Tears streamed down Anna's cheeks as she tells me her story. Anna says she tried to get help. She says she called the police one night he was beating her while she was pregnant. She says he was let go the next day. Nothing happened. And she says nothing got better. For the next few years, Anna says she was abused daily. She says her ex called her names and would hit her with whatever was in his hand for any reason. He would hit me and I had to get huge bruises. I didn't go out so people wouldn't see and ask me about it. But nearly a year ago, Anna took her son and, with the help of a family member, reached the Texas border. Anna says it was her best option because her son's father was never going to stop looking for them. While she was at a detention center in Texas, an asylum officer interviewed her. And according to the documents, the asylum officer found a credible fear finding, citing domestic violence. Clayson recalls the day Anna first came in to see him. He says he remembers telling her she would absolutely win her asylum case. But suddenly, things changed. For the record, Clayson's firm, the Yara Law Group, is a corporate supporter of Valley Public Radio.
So I put in my notes, I'm sorry, so right here, after I recalled her, I called her on June 19th, so June 7th, 12 days later, I call her June 19th, advised client of new Jeff Sessions asylum decision, frowny face, much less chance of win, of success.
On June 11th, Sessions announced citing domestic and gang violence no longer qualifies as an asylum claim. Like Anna, That decision put hundreds of others in the valley and thousands in the nation in limbo.
It's also new. Attorneys across the country are trying to formulate. We're trying to put her into a different box. I'm still trying to formulate that. No one really does quite yet. No one does. We're trying to formulate how we can put her into a social group without saying that the social group is women who are property of their domestic partnerships.
Clayson says his office has dozens of asylum cases around the San Joaquin Valley. He says most of his clients applying for asylum who are from Central America and Mexico were escaping domestic or gang violence. He says the outcome of Ana's and other asylum cases are going to depend on which judge they get.
It matters a lot, although the vast majority of judges in San Francisco make decisions that are favorable to immigrants in the asylum context.
According to data from TRAC, a nonpartisan and nonprofit data research center, over the years, asylum outcomes have continued to depend on which judge is assigned to the case. They've been compiling data on all asylum outcomes for more than a decade, and their most recent data follows that trend. The San Francisco Immigration Court is where Valley cases are heard, and according to TRAC data compiled from 2012 to 2017, the odds of getting an asylum case denied in San Francisco court ranges from about 9% to 97%, depending on which judge is assigned to the case. TRAC's report also mentions that it's natural for asylum decisions to vary since each case is different.
Individual asylum officers and judges consider individual cases. So it's really mixed. In some cases, you know, there have certainly been some cases denied after the AB decision. But in other cases, judges are still granting and attorneys are tweaking their arguments and submitting additional evidence in order to try and address the ways in which Sessions attempted to change the law.
That's Lindsay Harris. She's an assistant law professor at the University of the District of Columbia. She co-directs their Immigration and Human Rights Clinic and has a focus on asylum cases. She says more asylum cases will probably get denied than before.
One thing that's very certain is it's an absolute increase in attorney resources and time that have to be put into the cases and kind of redoing the cases and submitting new arguments and coming up with new particular social groups and submitting more evidence on country conditions and things.
When the Attorney General announced the asylum policy change, he said the law doesn't protect violent instances based on private or personal matters. And over time, Sessions says the asylum qualifications expanded beyond what Congress originally intended. Officials at the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services declined to do a recorded interview. But in an emailed statement to Valley Public Radio, spokesman Michael Barrs wrote, "The current system is prone to loopholes, fraud, and abuse, and prevents legitimate asylum seekers from being seen in a timely fashion." Back in Clayson's office, Ana stands up and shows me the scar she has on her calf from the machete attack. It's healed now, but the memory is still vivid. She can't know for sure, but Ana says if she stayed in El Salvador, she believes her ex would have killed her. Even though Ana's case will be an uphill battle, Ana and Clayson say they're both hopeful.
These are the cases that keep me up at night, to be honest. It's the cases that I think about over weekends and where you have to go even beyond 100%. Even the cases that you have to, every plausible argument that I can think of and conceive, I have to fight because it truly is a life and death situation.
It could take years until Ana knows what will happen in her asylum case. But she says at least now, she doesn't have to live with the torment of thinking her ex will find her. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
And now we turn to health. Over the last few weeks, we've been looking at how those who work in healthcare are at increased risk of workplace violence. In the next installment of our series, Part of the Job, FM89's Laura Sutsui reports that while hospitals in the Valley have preventive measures in place, some are finding that it's not until an incident happens that a facility knows what more to improve.
Community Regional Medical Center is in downtown Fresno. The hospital sees patients from its own neighborhood as well as those from all over the Central Valley. Nicole Osborne is the hospital's director of employee health and safety. She says that while incidents are common, not all of them are severe.
I get a ping just about every day, but sometimes it's just verbal. So it's not necessarily huge issues, but we want everybody to report everything because one of the things that we're fighting is stigma of that violence in healthcare is acceptable.
She says that this attitude starts with training. Everyone at CRMC receives online training about violence and what to do if something happens. But it also depends on where people work within the facility. Osborne says that those who face the public, like in the emergency department, receive more training than others.
And so our staff, they're trained to look for behavioral cues as warning signs with somebody that's becoming agitated or violent. So if we can catch somebody in a lower level situation where they're just confused or frustrated, it's easier to de-escalate them.
Osborne says employees watch for dangerous behaviors as soon as they set foot in the hospital. Anyone entering the emergency room first meets a security guard and walks through a metal detector.
So if something triggers the metal detector, then they know that they have to get further eyes on that person.
Osborne says the hospital is constantly making updates and investigating incidents to understand how to prevent violent encounters. At the same time, though, she says that being aware isn't limited to working at a hospital.
For any of our facilities or anywhere you go in your personal life, never let your guard down, because if you're in a public place, you're at risk.
With increased awareness of shootings in recent years, it's not surprising, then, that hospitals deal with guns, too.
It was on a Friday afternoon around 4:51. A staff member came up and said that there was somebody in the parking lot in the back employee entrance with a weapon.
Michelle Oxford is the CEO at Bakersfield Heart Hospital. In early December of last year, a man shot into the facility and entered with a rifle.
For a hospital, a person with a weapon is a code silver. So we called the code silver overhead. Our staff has had so much training that they know that that means to barricade themselves into whatever areas they are, make sure to keep the patients and family safe.
The man entered the building through an employee entrance. Oxford actually met him in the hallway when she was trying to check on her staff, and she says she immediately turned around and ran back to her office.
When Laura and I ran into my office, we both reached for the door to lock it, and there is not a lock because you unlock your door with your key on the outside. So we both sat down and tried to block the door with our bodies. So I don't think that's something you would ever think about without actually experiencing it.
The hospital has since added cameras, so-called Columbine locks, and replaced the employee entrance that the gunman shot through. But again, these were changes made after the active shooter incident. Before that, Bakersfield Heart was already working to comply with the new state regulation to decrease workplace violence in healthcare. Gail Blanchard-Sager is with the California Hospital Association. She says that while hospitals take safety seriously, the new California state rule is an unfunded mandate. Facilities have had limited resources to become compliant.
And that's why, you know, I think there are a lot of resources out there because people need to kind of pick what works best for their, you know, downtown LA is different than Madeira.
Additionally, she says the new state reporting system implemented by the rule lacks nuance.
If you can't kind of get to the genesis of what the situation was, then how can you look at preventing it? Because I think there's, in reality, you're never going to get to zero.
The rule requires that incidents are reported within 24 hours, but Blanchard-Sager says it's hard for facilities to get to the root of why something happened in that time. She adds that she's not sure if the regulation will decrease incidents because data on violence in healthcare is limited to begin with. But perhaps that's exactly what required reporting and a change in culture can contribute to. And as Blanchard-Sager says, hospitals will never eliminate incidents entirely. Violence in any job may never be completely avoidable. But for those in healthcare, the hope is that it is no longer simply part of the job. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
This story was produced as a project for the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism's 2018 California Fellowship. And now we turn to air quality. It was only a few weeks ago that wildfires drove particle pollution to dangerously high levels in many parts of the San Joaquin Valley and mountain areas, and it could happen again before wildfire season is over. Particulate matter, or PM as it's called, is a major health risk. It's known to cause asthma attacks and other respiratory flare-ups in the short term, and exposure over the long term has been associated with reduced immune function and cardiovascular problems. Now, a growing body of research is linking PM and other air pollutants to problems with another part of the body, the brain. Two recent wide-reaching reports associate the pollutant with a decline in cognitive function. Here to explain these papers is Dr. John Balmes, a pulmonary physician and environmental health researcher with the University of California. He was not involved in either of these studies, but does co-lead a major study of air pollution and health here in Fresno. Thanks for being here, Dr. Balmes.
It's my pleasure.
So two big studies published in August examined the health impacts of air pollution. One, a scientific paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that examined cognitive ability. The other study, a working paper by the National Bureau of Economics Research that investigated dementia. Can you tell me a little bit about these studies? What do they show and what was their methodology for getting there?
Yes, well, both studies are strong methodologically. The first study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences used data from China, where they had a large population of older folks who were taking basically mental fitness examinations to test their math and verbal abilities. And they used China's EPA data from air quality monitoring in multiple cities, over 80, across China. So they had a wide spectrum of PM levels. And, you know, of course, China has much worse PM problems than we do in the U.S., even in the San Joaquin Valley. And they found an association between PM and decreased math and verbal test scores. And they found that these decreased scores were below China's standard for PM10 of 50 micrograms per meter cubed. That's one sort of problem with the study, is that it's PM10, larger size particulate. We're mostly concerned about the health effects of smaller particles, PM2.5. Now, the second study, a U.S. study, was even bigger in terms of sample size than China, because they used Medicare data and they had almost 7 million people in the study. And they, again, used U.S. EPA monitoring data from across the country to assign exposures to PM2.5 to these 7 million individuals. And they showed, again, an association between diagnosis of dementia, so that's very bad cognitive function, and PM2.5 levels, and at levels even below the current standard. The current standard in the U.S. is 12 micrograms per meter cubed for PM2.5. And given that Fresno, the San Joaquin Valley as a whole, is a non-attainment area for PM2.5, it's alarming. Dementia, which is often caused by Alzheimer's disease, there are other causes, but Alzheimer's is the big one. That's a huge problem in terms of the social costs as well as the individual health problems that dementia brings, because we have to care for our loved ones who have dementia, and that's very expensive. And so the study from the U.S., the Medicare data study, estimated the costs of this increased dementia related to PM2.5, and the costs were like $150 billion. That sounds like an astronomical figure, but if you think about what it takes in terms of caring for a loved one with dementia for possibly many years in a skilled nursing facility or at home with round-the-clock care, it gets very expensive quickly. So these two studies are sort of a wake-up call about the health effects of PM2.5 on the nervous system. And I guess I would add one other thing. It's not just older people. There is increasing evidence that younger kids, their cognitive development, i.e. how much IQ they get, is also affected by PM2.5. So we're starting to see evidence that both at the start of the life course and the end of the life course that PM2.5 can affect cognitive function.
So really a lot of implications of these studies, as you said, especially given that parts of California are in some of the worst non-attainment areas of the country when it comes to particulate matter, you know, and the financial implications of what this could mean for these health impacts in the elderly. So these studies both have enormous sample sizes. As you said, the study in PNAS using data from China, tens of thousands of adults were surveyed in this study. And then, of course, there's 7 million adults who were studied in the paper from the U.S. So these are enormous sample sizes. It sounds like you trust these findings, that these papers seem pretty reputable.
Yes. So PNAS is one of the top scientific journals in the U.S. That's where the China study was published. And the Medicare study, the econometric study, I just read it carefully. I think it's very well done. And it probably will be published in some other form.
And so this link between air pollution and the brain, is this a new focus of research? Did these papers break new ground?
Actually, not really. There are very strong papers that add to the evidence that was already accumulating. But there are several studies, one in Canada, one in the U.S., that have already pointed to this association. It's really an association of air pollution with cognitive dysfunction, cognitive decline, dementia. We don't really know the mechanism, and so we can't really, from these studies, say that air pollution is causing these problems. It's highly likely because the association keeps showing up in multiple studies, but we don't really have the experimental evidence yet to show that there's a causal link. I think it's coming. I'm sure that there are many investigators using animal models to try to prove that this is a cause and effect. I think there are enough data that we should be concerned about this, and it provides further evidence that we need to be trying to clean up the air as much as possible in California, which we're trying to do. And the PM2.5 levels in the San Joaquin Valley are better than they were a decade ago, in large part because we are reducing emissions from diesel, heavy-duty diesel trucks and buses. So we just have to keep working harder to clean up our air.
So where does this leave us when it comes to the cumulative associations that we know about between health and particulate matter? I gave a couple general examples in my introduction, but can you lay out all the health conditions that have been implicated in the exposure to particulate matter?
Yes, as I mentioned, these health effects are throughout the life course. So in utero exposures have been associated with adverse birth outcomes like preterm birth, low birth weight, and even birth defects. In children, there's increased risk for allergy, asthma, growth of lung function, and cognitive ability. In older adults, there are respiratory effects, increased risk for asthma exacerbations of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, that's chronic bronchitis and emphysema, usually caused by smoking, but air pollution can cause exacerbations. Cardiovascular disease is very important, heart attacks, strokes, and that leads to increased cardiopulmonary mortality, meaning individuals with pre-existing heart and lung disease are more likely to die when PM2.5 levels are high. And then we're now talking about the effects on the aging brain. There's even some evidence that Parkinson's may be contributed to by PM2.5 exposures.
And you, of course, are involved with the Children's Health and Air Pollution Study, CHAPS for short, which examines health impacts in babies, infants, and youth here in Fresno. So how does this growing body of research on the brain, well, not just on the brain, but just of health impacts in general of air pollution, how does that impact your work with CHAPS?
Well, any new health effects of air pollution research tends to motivate us to continue our own work. And what we're focused on in the current funding cycle of CHAPS, which has actually been going on for almost two decades now in one form or another, is on obesity, diabetes, blood pressure in our kids. And those are risk factors for the metabolic syndrome in adults, which is associated with cardiovascular disease and mortality. And I'm hoping to have some results to share with the Fresno community, which has been very supportive of our study for these many years, and so we want to be giving back to them for all their support. We're hoping to have some results to share soon with regard to those outcomes I mentioned, obesity, glucose dysregulation as a precursor for diabetes, and blood pressure in kids. We're actually finding some air pollution effects on blood pressure that is particularly alarming because we're talking about seven-year-old kids. So,
well, that's really interesting. That's something something we hope to see soon. So Dr. John Balmes is a physician and health researcher with the University of California, and he's a principal investigator with the Fresno Children's Health and Air Pollution Study, or CHAPS. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. We're less than 2 months away from this year's midterm election. Democrats are still holding out for a blue wave across the country, but whether that will extend into conservative strongholds in the Central Valley is yet to be seen. Today in our studios, we are talking to Andrew Janz, a Fresno County prosecutor and Democrat running against incumbent Republican Congressman Devin Nunes. Andrew, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And so I wanted to ask you, you're still attending to your day job as a prosecutor. Is there a point when you go from full-time prosecutor to full-time campaign mode? When does that start happening?
Yeah, the county has finally granted my leave request. I go on leave starting October 9th.
And so what's it kind of like around the water cooler then? I know sometimes that's a more conservative crowd. How have they reacted to your run now that we're getting closer and closer to the election?
You know, at first, many of my colleagues at the DA's office were pretty skeptical about my run, as were, I think, a lot of people here in the Central Valley. And as we've progressed over the last year and a half, I think that a lot of people are starting to believe that we can have real change here in the Central Valley, which is why my colleagues at the Fresno County DA's office has endorsed my campaign.
And turning to your position on policy, I want to ask you about water. It's obviously a big issue for the Central Valley. Your latest campaign ad called out your opponent, Devin Nunes, saying that he's failed to deliver on water legislation, although he did co-sponsor the GROW Act from Congressman David Valadao. That was also co-sponsored by Democrat Jim Costa. But then it was also opposed by Senators Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris. And you've also said that you would want to work with our senators. And so I'm curious, regarding that legislation specifically, are you on the side of the senators in opposing the GROW Act, or are you with fellow Democrat Jim Costa?
You know, water is the lifeblood of the Central Valley. And the bottom line is that we don't have enough. And so despite Devin Nunes co-sponsoring pieces of legislation from time to time, I don't think that he's done enough on this issue. He's been in Congress for 8 terms, and I've been talking to growers since the very beginning, and the consensus is we don't have enough water. That's the bottom line. And I grew up in this district. My grandfather worked in agriculture. My dad worked in a food processing plant here in the Central Valley tied to agriculture. My job as a county prosecutor depends on ag, just like everyone else's job here in the Central Valley. And so I know how important it is to make sure that we have the water projects necessary for our farmers to continue to feed the rest of the nation. I view it as a vital national security issue. And I want to make sure that any representative that we send to Washington is going to work for the growers and the farmers of the Central Valley, and also for our communities. It frustrates me that there are parts of the valley that have clean drinking water problems. There's parts outside of Exeter where communities are being told to boil their water before they drink it, and that shouldn't be the case in the richest country in the nation. And so I'm going to go out there and be an advocate for these farmers and an advocate for our communities. We don't have enough water, and Devin Nunes has failed us.
So I guess in the instance of trying to get more water for our farmers then, I mean, do you think that, you know, pumping water from the Delta, as Congressman Valadao is suggesting in this legislation, do you think that's what we should do?
I think that that should be part of the approach. I think that we need to get the pumps going back at 100% capacity. I think that we need to do things like raise Shasta Dam. I think we need to have federal funding for projects like Temperance Flat Dam. If you go back to 2017 and look at a piece of legislation that was sponsored by Devin Nunes, H.R. 23, there's language in there that actually says no water for projects like Temperance Flat Dam. And the growers and farmers that I talk to think that's the wrong approach. I am talking about a massive infrastructure spending plan for the Central Valley. And this is not only with respect to water, but to for transportation as well. And we're going to have a new Congress next year, and so we're going to have a new opportunity. And I actually believe, even though I'm a Democrat, that this is an area that we can work with President Trump on, because he talked a lot about infrastructure spending. Democrats want to spend money in our communities to make sure that we have these projects. The Republicans in Congress have been very opposed to it, and that's evident in this bill that Devin Nunes sponsored last year.
Regarding Temperance Flat Dam as an infrastructure and a water storage project, so that would be like a $3 billion project to store about 100,000 acre-feet of water. Some might say that's not really worth it. Do you think that's a good investment?
Well, there is no silver bullet to the water issue. What we need to do is to make sure that we do have storage projects like Temperance Flat Dam in place. It's symbolic. And we also need to have better conveyance systems, canals, tunnels, and things like that that go along with it. We need to make sure that we have infrastructure in place that will allow our growers and our landowners to recharge groundwater aquifers that have been completely decimated over the course of the last decade or so. And so if we have things in place that will allow that to happen, I will absolutely support those programs.
You mentioned earlier that as a Democrat, you want to work with our president on infrastructure projects. You would like to get us to pumping water at 100%. And Trump has told the Bureau of Reclamation to increase pumping out of the Delta, but that would put fish species at risk. And so how would you weigh the need for farmers to get the water they want against environmental concerns and the desire to preserve and restore habitats?
You know, I want to make sure that the federal government and the state of California invest in new scientific research to come up with new ideas to help better protect these species that are in danger. But at the same time, I think that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. You know, there's no reason why we can't support water projects and protect the environment at the same time. I want to make sure that we have a strategy in place that does take the environment into consideration. But I'll tell you, my priority is to the Central Valley. It is to the growers and the communities that are here. And I mentioned it before, we feed the rest of the nation, and it's a vital national security issue. We can't have other countries growing our food, and nobody does it better than the Central Valley. Look, we grow half of the nation's fruits, nuts, and vegetables. We have 270 different types of crops that grow here in the Central Valley, and I am so proud of that. And I want to make sure that our folks here have the water necessary to continue to do the mission that they've done so well in the past.
So I want to turn now to public safety. A case playing out at home is that of Nick Calls, a 17-year-old who was killed in North Fresno in a botched robbery attempt. And that person, Joseph Espinoza, had a run-in with the police earlier that day. So let's play a quote from the Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer on that.
Well, we do know that prior to Proposition 47 passing, possession of methamphetamine was a felony, and we would book those individuals into the jail when they were in possession of methamphetamine. Espinosa was in possession of methamphetamine, but instead of being booked into jail for a felony under Proposition 47, he was issued a misdemeanor citation for that charge. Had he been in custody that night and the next day, he would not have been in a position to commit those robberies, shootings, and the murder of Nicholas Call.
And so, do you agree with Chief Dyer that Prop 47 is to blame for the circumstances leading up to the murder of Nick Calls?
Look, I'll say this. There is nothing more important to me than the safety of our community and the safety of our families. This is why I'm a prosecutor. That's why I go out there every single day to make sure that we take dangerous criminals off our streets. My last assignment before I announced into this campaign was with the Violent Crimes Unit. So I see this firsthand every single day. And I've been very vocal about my opposition to propositions like 47 and 57. I think that the chief is right with regard to the fact that this person may not have been out on our streets if it weren't for Proposition 47. You know, when some of these crimes were felonies, we were able actually to get some of these folks help because it was a felony. They would be held accountable under a probation scheme that if they weren't to follow sort of the guidelines laid out by the court, that they would be sent to prison. So there isn't that anymore. So they basically get a ticket and they get to move along. And we've seen an uptick in burglaries and other theft crimes as a result of Prop 47. You know, I don't think that the verdict is in yet, but it's pretty clear to me from the law enforcement perspective that there are some issues there. And let me also say this. He wouldn't have killed the victim in this case if he didn't have a gun. And for me, there needs to be more accountability with respect to gun ownership. I own guns. I support the Second Amendment, but I don't think that the Second Amendment is without limitation. So we need to make sure that it isn't this easy for folks like this to go out there and buy a gun. And we take a lot of guns off the streets. You know, in the first quarter of this year, Fresno police, working with other local law enforcement, including my office, took nearly 300 guns off of our streets. Many of those guns at some point belonged to a person who legally possessed that firearm but failed to properly store it. And in so many of my cases, we have stolen firearms that are being used in the commission of crimes just like this. So we need to make it harder for folks like this to get guns. We need to have universal background checks. We need to close the gun show loophole. And folks that own guns should be held accountable if they don't store their guns properly. We had an infant, a young person here in the district that just recently shot themselves in the head with their parents' firearms. So people like that should be held accountable. And so I'll go out there and continue to do that.
And you mentioned you have problems with Prop 47. In general, do you feel like these criminal justice reforms are making us less safe? That's what Chief Dyer and even District Attorney Lisa Smitkamp have been saying as well.
You know, I'm in favor of criminal justice reform. I think we all are. But there's a right way to do it. And one of the reasons why I'm running for Congress is to make sure that we do have the perspective of prosecutors serving in elected government and elected office. And I don't think that there's enough folks like me up in Sacramento that can provide insight into some of these very pressing issues. And so when you don't have prosecutors and other experts who work in law enforcement participating in the drafting of these pieces of legislation, you get laws that aren't well thought out, like Prop 47, where you have people that are released without any conditions, basically on a citation, and they're allowed to go out there and continue to victimize folks. And so my priority is to protect families, and it's to protect victims. At the same time, I want to make sure that we have just outcomes for people that are charged with offenses, even those that are charged with violent crimes. And so I support initiatives to make sure that our criminal justice system is fair and one that doesn't take into account someone's economic status.
Speaking of economic status, California just eliminated cash bail, which is something that our governor has said will, you know, make our system more equal. And it also gives judges more authority in this area. As a prosecutor, you're obviously familiar with this. And so is this a good move for the state?
You know, I think the jury's still out on this one as well. It's a new program. We'll see what happens. I'm concerned that people may not return to court if they're allowed to be out without a cash incentive to return. But here's the thing. Here's the reality of all this. We've already been doing this system here in Fresno County, and we've been doing it, I think, successfully. And what we have here in Fresno County is a system that doesn't ask how much money someone makes before releasing them onto some sort of supervision. What we do is we ask two questions. We ask, number one, are they a threat to the community? Do they have a criminal record? Are they a danger to other people? Number two, we ask if they're a flight risk. Are they going to come back to court? Do they have a history of failing to report to court? So if you meet those two criteria, we release you supervised by a probation officer, and you have to call in, you have to check in, you have to show up to court. And if not, we lock you up and keep you in until your trial date. And it's a system that's been working fine. What I'm concerned about with this new law is that really this is an unfunded mandate by Sacramento. And I don't know if we're going to have the resources here in Fresno County, and we're looking at it right now. We might need to have a DA on call 24/7. We might need to have more hirings with respect to probation officers to make sure that they can go out and do these risk assessments. You know, the one part of this law that I like is the fact that if you're charged with a violent offense, you're not released. You have to sit in jail pending trial. Before, if you were wealthy enough, you can pay the cash bond and get out. So there are certain aspects of this piece of legislation that I like. There are certain aspects that I don't like, and I think that's evident in the public discussion. You have folks on the left, like the ACLU and other organizations, that are saying that this is a terrible piece of legislation. Then you have folks on the right, many folks who work in law enforcement, who are saying that this is going to increase failures to appear. And so it looks like to me the governor tried to find a healthy middle ground. And I know that this is a process that went through vigorous vetting. There was a judicial panel that looked at it. A number of interested parties looked into it and participated in the drafting and discussion of this piece of legislation. So I don't want to jump to any conclusions yet. I want to see how it works out. But for me, the positive out of all of this is that violent criminals aren't going to be able to get out.
All right, and we're just going to have to leave it there. We've been talking to Andrew Janz, a congressional candidate and Fresno County prosecutor, in our studios today. Andrew, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
With claims of fake news and alternative facts dominating social media and news headlines, it's probably no surprise public trust in media has taken a big hit in recent years. A new effort at Fresno State aims to help reverse that trend. The university's new Institute for Media and Public Trust, led by former Fresno Bee editor Jim Boren, aims to improve the credibility gap between news producers and consumers. They have one of their first public events coming up next Monday, a forum on the First Amendment and academic freedom taking place at Fresno State. Valley Public Radio's Joe Moore caught up with Boren yesterday to learn more about the program and the latest research on the issue.
Jim, I want to talk about the First Amendment forum that you have coming up next Monday at Fresno State in a little bit. But before we do that, I want to go back to this other issue, which you've blogged about recently, and we've talked about on this program a couple of weeks ago. We had Alexandra Jaffe from Vice News on, and she did a big profile of the dispute between Devin Nunes and the Fresno Bee that has really exploded into the national stage recently. And we talked about this new survey from the Poynter Institute about public trust in local media. As somebody who spent his whole career in local media before going to academia, how does it make you feel to see the way Americans have a trust issue in some ways with national media, but it seems like they have a little more faith in local organizations? How do you interpret that from your perspective as an industry veteran?
Well, you know, you'd always like to have a higher level of trust. The local television news and local newspapers and other broadcast outlets are trusted at a higher rate than the national newspapers and broadcast outlets. I see that a lot, like, people don't like Congress in general, but they like their member of Congress. So I think the closer you are to the media, you understand them much more closely, and it's easier not to trust people that you aren't as engaged with. But there's still a quarter of the people don't trust even the local news outlets, and that's not a good thing. It's not good for civic engagement, and we need to build that trust back between news consumers and media outlets, and that's one of the reasons that we've established this institute at Fresno State.
Now, you talk a lot about media literacy. Is not the issue of trust sort of the, to use a cliche, the double-edged sword, the idea that people need to think critically about where they're getting their information and maybe how that information was gathered and the credibility of those sources? Isn't that also part of the message that you're bringing?
Yeah, it surely is. And, I think that we need to think more critically about our news sources, especially in the age of the internet. But also, there's another issue that is really hovering over all this, and that's the not even as much about trust, but about ideology. People on both sides of the partisan divide want news content that reflects their point of view. Cable news now has given them what they want, news that's slanted to the left or the right to fit their view of the facts. And I don't think that's good. You can't really have a serious debate of the issues if you don't accept the basic facts at hand. So the result is people talking past each other based on what the talking points they've picked up on MSNBC or Fox News. It's not good for media. It's definitely not good for our civic engagement and our democracy.
on the broadcast cable news side, there's a very gray line, if a line at all in some cases, between opinion coverage and bona fide news coverage. The newspaper industry developed differently in traditions over a century. How do you think the conventional idea of the opinion page serves local newspapers today? And is it time to look at something different there, or is it even more vital today?
I think it's even more vital today. What I'd like to see especially on the cable broadcast outlets, is that, you know, they mostly, their content is panels of talking heads on one side of the issue or another, you know, making their points. I think that they need to label that a lot more openly as this is opinion. I mean, I think they do a fine job on the hour when they actually present, you know, legitimate news of the day that's going on. But most often on cable news, and what people mostly watch are opinion folks, you know, giving their opinion, and it's not news. And I think it would help the news consumer if it was more clearly labeled as opinion.
Now, you have this First Amendment Forum coming up at Fresno State. Certainly the university has been in the news a lot recently due to comments from a number of faculty members that gained widespread attention in social media and beyond that were highly inflammatory, some would say offensive. And that has really thrust this issue of academic freedom into a new light. Your institute is focused on journalism. How do you see this forum informing our view of both journalism and the First Amendment? How does this fit with what you're working on?
Well, at the heart of what we're doing at the Fresno State Institute for Media and Public Trust is the First Amendment. So this is a First Amendment forum. Dr. Castro, the university president, asked us to host it, and we were more than happy to do that. And so we're going to have First Amendment lawyers. We are going to have professors, we're having a student body president, and others discuss these kinds of issues that are going on not just on the Fresno State campus, but campuses across the country, and even in the K-12 schools, because there's a lot of free speech issues that are happening now in some of the high schools in the Valley and across the country.
Jim Bourne with us today from Fresno State's Institute for Media and Public Trust. You're really launching this fall, your institute, with a lot of activities and things. Tell us a little more about what's on the way and what you're working on.
Well, you know, we've got several already other programs planned. We've got an ethics program that's going to be later in the month. Down the line, we are going to look at how the media cover things like agricultural issues and similar kinds of things. We're going to look at the trust issue and the openness of news outlets to be transparent in how they present their news. And beyond that, how they explain to their readers and viewers and listeners about the process. I think one of the things that media have not done well in the past is explain how they gather news and put it together. And I think that was going to be helpful. So we want to be a convener of those conversations and help. We see the Institute as being in the middle between the news consumer and the media outlets. We want to bring everybody to the table and have good discussions and hopefully, you know, bridge that trust gap.
Before we go, I want to follow up on that thought about increased transparency and talking about how the sausage is made, so to speak, in the media. In many cases, that's not been something that's historically done, at least initially when a story is published. We're starting to see that now. The Bee has done some of that with their recent coverage of Devin Nunes, talking about this is who we talked to, this is who didn't want to talk to us, this is why this person is in the story and this person isn't. How unique is that? And are we going to see more of that? And is it going to address this type of issue? The type of thing that can rebuild that sort of trust with the audience and the news consumer?
I think it's a good first step. It's clearly we have a long ways to go. The divide is huge, and we need to do a lot. But being much more transparent, being much more open. You know, when I was editor, I would go out and make public appearances, and people were very interested in how we put a story together and how the editorial board worked and other kinds of things. And I know that the new editor, Joe Keat, over at the newspaper is doing that also. But you can't reach all that many people, just going to service clubs and others. So they need to use, the resources that they have in their stories, explaining how this story went together, or that story went together. I think it's a really, really good idea. But it's an important first step, but a lot more needs to be done to rebuild that trust.
And we'll be encouraged to see the work coming out of your organization in the weeks, months, and years to come. Again, the Institute for Media and Public Trust at Fresno State, headed up by former Fresno Bee editor Jim Boren. They're presenting a First Amendment Forum at Fresno State next Monday at the Leon S. and Pete P. Peters Educational Center and the Student Recreation Center, talking about the First Amendment, academic freedom, and related issues. You can find more information online at the Institute's website. Jim, how can we find you online?
MediaandPublicTrust.com.
Looking forward to that. And Jim, always good to talk to you.
Thanks, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. This weekend, the Tulare County Museum in Visalia is hosting an event in collaboration with the California Indian Basket Weavers Association and in honor of California Native American Day. The event is called Roots Run Deep, and to talk about what this means for Native American traditions local to the area, we are speaking with Jennifer Malone, who's with the California Indian Basket Weavers Association. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And so can you tell us a little bit about this event? Is it just a day of basket weaving all day?
Actually, it's to educate the public. We will be having different classes throughout the day. But we are showing a film on Who Speaks Wukchumni, which is my tribe. And the film is a documentary that was created, and it's my mother, Marie Wilcox, who is the last fluent speaker of the Wukchumni tribe. So we will be sharing that film in the auditorium at 1 o'clock. And before that, we will share a PowerPoint by my sister showing how to gather our white root for our basket weaving. Mm. And so it'll be a full day of just being there with us and learning our traditions and culture.
Yeah. And so is there like a specific tribe that the traditions you're talking about, this basket weaving, obviously that language, is there, is it just one local group that this pertains to?
No, we have many local groups. And in our group, we have the Wukchumni, Yalupni, Tachi, Mono, Wuxachi, and so those are all the close different tribal people that will be doing the presentations and the teachings. So mm-hmm. All natives from the local area.
Mm-hmm. And it's specifically sort of Tulare County and Central Valley, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and you just said, your mother is the last native speaker of Wukchumni, and she'll be there as well. And so I'm curious, would you maybe characterize this event as just showcasing these traditions and practices, or maybe even one to pass them on?
Actually, I'm hoping to be able to pass it on to anyone that's really interested, because it's more than just one day of basket weaving. We have to go out and gather. We have to learn the times to gather, how to prepare the materials and different things like that. So it's a lot of education, environmental things going on with our plant.
And so I'm curious, why do you think it's important to have this event and to hold on to these traditions to, showcase them and try to pass them on?
It is so important because this is to show how we survived a long time ago, and we are still surviving with doing all of our cultural traditions and song ceremonies. And so to me, it's so important to pass this on to our youth, anyone that, you know, that will be coming. We're hoping to keep them within our group so that we can just keep all of our Native traditions alive.
And so it sounds like, you know, your involvement in this and your background is really because you have like a family history of doing this. But I'm curious, you know, do you have to have that family history or have to know, you know, have some sort of a background or know how to weave a basket to come and enjoy?
No. We've had a lot of beginners and, you know, it's like people come and they say, I want to learn how to make a basket. And so we take them out to dig in the dirt and clip on the trees and then they break a fingernail or something. Oh, I don't think I want to do this. But we do have some committed and that want to stay and keep coming back. So, you know, we're hoping to get them excited about working with us and completing a basket.
Yeah, it sounds like a really great opportunity for anyone, you know, interested in learning about these arts and this culture that is, you know, native to this area, to come and learn more. So I guess what kind of a crowd are you guys expecting this weekend?
Oh, I'm expecting a big crowd because we've shared it with all Tehachapi and on Facebook, and we have a lot of language speakers from the South that will be coming in. Our California Basket Weavers director will be there with us. So it's just passing on and sharing what we have and hoping that it makes the people feel so good about themselves, you know, and who they are.
Awesome. Well, Jennifer, I think that's where we'll have to leave us. But, you know, roots run deep. This is a basket weaving event happening this Saturday, but there will be more than just weaving, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Tulare County Museum in Visalia. And it's going to be inside Mooney Grove Park. The event is free, but you do have to pay for parking. Anyways, Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And that's Valley Edition for Tuesday, September 11th. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at KVPR. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio. And you can send us comments and find our emails at kvpr.org.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Valley Edition podcast and download the KVPR mobile app for your smartphone or tablet. Thanks to our editor, Joe Moore, fellow reporter Monica Velez, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Laura Satsui. We're filling in for Joe Moore.
You've been listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.